Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and welcome to the Classic Series Redrive. Check them up. Let's get started.
Welcome in to the Classic Series Redrive, episode number 93. Mark Hostetler here in Southern Michigan. We have Kyle Forsythe in Manan, Idaho. Also, Logan Reinhold in the Reinhold Tech and Western Wear Studios, controlling the soundboard and trying to make us guys sound halfway decent here. Kyle, what's going on in your neck of the woods these days?
Well, we gave the horses about a month off after the Arizona shows and kind of full swing back training hard, and got the Grand Junction show, Grand Junction, Colorado, the show, the Western States Classic. I forget what it's called. I think that's what it's called. Clark's kind of put that on, kind of the Clark family's hometown show, and we're about 3 weeks from it, so kind of getting things dialed in back up. Ramped up for that. Got quite a few horses with shoes on and just kind of driving away.
Springtime yet?
Close, yeah. Actually, the farmer across the road from us here planted barley when I was at Madison sale, and it's the whole field's green. So, yeah, I would say, yeah, we're kind of getting into that, you know, 60s and creeping into the 70s some days. And, yeah, it's been pretty good. How about Michigan?
Yeah, we had kind of a stretch there where it got a little warm and everything turned green, but we've had some cool weather here recently, last few days. But it's supposed to, this week, it's supposed to be a little chilly. Then after that, we're looking at the long-term forecast is looking like in the 70s next week. So I think we're right around the corner. And yeah, kind of same here. I've been doing some driving and getting ready. Our first show will be in Wilmington there the 1st of June at Ray Houston and Vicky and the crew put on, and so we'll be heading there. So yeah, we've been driving and try to get some mares in shape here. But big sale over the weekend. The National Clyde sale was last weekend, and my understanding was they had quite a few outs. I guess people might have sold a few horses before the sale, but they still had about 100 head or so. And I guess from reports I got was it was a pretty good sale, I guess. Sold some decent geldings. I know Gord Campbell sold four up, and from my understanding is they all went to a carriage company and all brought pretty darn good money from what I heard.
Yeah, like two over 30,000, 38, 30, 34, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And Abby Brander put a gelding through there that Cody Woodbury fit for pretty good money as well. Went out to Utah to the High Point Clydesdales there. Brett Nanette bought him. Saw a video of him. He kind of looked pretty cool. Kind of cool front endy. Looked like a younger horse. But nonetheless, the big Clyde sale, like we always say, there was about a 5-day event to sell 100 head of horses, but it's always a good time. They have a banquets and meals, and they do it right. And really about the only other big sale coming up is this week in Dover, Ohio. They're the Buckeye Draft Horse and Colt sale. Looks like they got a pretty decent consignment. Again, a lot of locals there from Holmes County consigning yearlings, and they have their futurity there as well. So, yeah, that sale's coming up this week.
Yep. Yeah, that's always kind of the cap on the spring sales, it seems like. And then Seymour kind of is the one summer sale. And before you know it, it's fall sale season again. Yeah, I would say the market, it started off like super strong. It maybe just tailed off a tick towards the end of the sale season. But all in all, I think the horse market's staying strong.
No, I think so, too. No, I really do. And it seems like there's a lot of interest in people, you know, breeding mares. Every guy you talk with that stands a stud or two or has a facility that is standing studs, they're breeding mares like crazy. And that's the encouraging thing, is people are breeding a lot of horses for sure this time of the year once it warms up a little bit. And so that's the encouraging thing. At least people are breeding and try to raise the next sale topper and show stopper, I guess what they say.
There you go. Just regular old auctioneer speak there, Mark.
yeah.
What's new with the Classic Series? Any information we need to get out to people?
Yeah, we're doing some updates on the website. We're redoing some stuff on the website there. Not that big of a deal, but just give it a fresh look and be looking in your emails here relatively soon. The Hall of Fame voting will get sent out. I think it's pretty important, not only in the Classic Series, but even in your breed organizations, just to recognize people that have made a difference in the industry. And there's been a lot of people that have made, you know, a big difference in the Classic Series and draft horse industry in general. And, you know, just recognizing them, people, and honoring them for all the work and effort they put in. So you should be getting an email here relatively soon on the nominations for that. And just make sure you take the time and vote on if you you know, who you think is worthy of extra recognition in the Classic Series Hall of Fame. We're also going to be expanding our social media here relatively soon. It's going to be starting. We're going to be trying to get a reach out, more of a reach on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube. We're just going to be putting out some reels, some highlight reels and stuff. And be on the lookout for that and share those videos. And it's just to get more engagement, get the public more involved. We'll have, you know, show updates coming up in those reels and engage in the public more so and try to see if we can get. And a lot of it has to do with hopefully getting people to the shows to watch to benefit the shows. That's kind of one of the main reasons we're doing it.
Yeah, it's really so important for our industry. You know, obviously the expansion and development and future of our industry kind of depends on some of that, right? So the more content and information we can get out to the public and we can grow our fan base, it just benefits everybody.
Yeah, and if you have any videos at home or if you have any videos of, you know, something you think is unique and cool, just send it to Brenda. You know, she'll be working on a few other people with those things, and we can maybe, she'll be working with, I guess would say Jolene Yoder and her are going to be working together on doing a lot of social media things for us. So hopefully we'll get that going here relatively soon, but just be sure to share the reels and the content that gets put out. Just like I said, once again, just to, make the public more aware of the draft horse and the six horse hitches and the halter horses and the carts and the kids and all that stuff. And like I said, at the end of the day, we really want to get more people to the shows to sit in and watch at, whether it's a small county fair, standalone show, or even at a state fair or stock show, just to get more people educated about the draft horses. But that's about all we got going on, I think, right now. And, you know, once again, we say it every time, but don't forget to, you know, to buy Spark Plug Coffee. Keep you awake in the morning and keep you going. Help support the kids. Also, the merchandise. Make sure you look online for some merchandise. And like I said before, it's not something that you're going to get 2 days like you do from Amazon. This is custom made, so it'll take a little while. And Kyle, you've ordered some stuff, and so have I. And it took 3 to 4 weeks to get it, you know, because, like I say, it is custom ordered.
But it is nice stuff. And I mean, the compliments I've got from the Classic Series Redrive podcast merchandise, I've been sporting on my head and chest. And I mean, it's unreal. People love it. So you want to be cool like me, you better buy some Classic Series Redrive.
shoot. Hey, and speaking of clothing, you know, talking with Logan, you know, he won't say anything on here, but make sure you check out ReinholdWesternWear.com as well. All his spring and summer clothing is up now in the store and fully stocked with summer clothes. So make sure you check out the website and
see what all he's got. You'll be cooler than wearing Classic Series Redrive merchandise if you buy some stuff from Logan.
Yeah. shoot. Yeah. Kind of a neat episode we got here, Kyle. We sat down with a guy that hasn't been in the draft horse. Well, he hasn't, I guess he hasn't been totally out of it. He's been following it the way it sounds, you know, but since he'd been about 16 years old, upper 40s now, but we had a chance to sit down with Chester Weber and have a conversation. Of course, everybody knows Chester from the Live Oak plantation down in Ocala, Florida, and the Live Oak hitch that showed a hitch of Clydesdale geldings back in the day, Classic Series champions, and traveled all over the country there for a couple of years.
Yeah, and they left their imprint on the draft horse breed. You know, you think back to some of the great sires and mares over the years that came out of there, from both the breeding and the hitching. They were top notch. I mean, in their time, they were buying. You know, you think back to the Cooper family and the Clydesdales that they raised, and then for that legacy to go on to Live Oak and then on to Highland after that. I mean, it was just a string of tremendous horse talent came through that place and great horsemen. I know Chester touched on it quite a bit through the episode, but obviously Jim Westbrook and then the people he surrounded himself with, all the Freetag boys, and just a lot of great horsemen come through that operation.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of those episodes where Kyle and I don't really have to do anything besides sit there and just talk every now and then a little bit, because Chester just talked, and he's got this achievement program that he's been kind of doing some, sounds like he's been going and visiting places and having lectures on this achievement program he's got. And so, very interesting guy to talk to. He, well, you'll hear in the episode here, almost everything he does, horse-wise, relates back to when they were showing the Clydes. And he just learned so much about driving and fine detail and everything else. Super guy. I mean,
he's so intelligent, too. I mean, just a lot of insight, and you can just tell he sees a lot of big picture perspective stuff. And yeah, just super knowledgeable guy.
Yep, great listen. Was a pleasure for us to sit down and talk with Chester. You know, very celebrated driver in combined driving and also with the Clydes. And that's all for now, and enjoy the episode, and we'll see you guys down the road.
The Smith family has been in the meat snack business since 1975. There are now four generations of Smiths working with Glenwood Snacks. Glenwood Beef Jerky is made with solid pieces of 100% premium beef and smoked with real wood smoke. Their jerky is in high protein, low in calories, and darn good to eat. Also, look out for new lines of meat sticks. Look for the Double S Belgians, the equine ambassadors of Glenwood Beef Jerky, at a show near you. Browse our many flavors of 100% beef jerky, signature meat sticks, and snack bundles at glenwoodsnacks.com. Follow on Facebook, Instagram, or by calling 208-624-9851. Orders over $50 ship for free. Glenwood Snacks.
So, my life story. I'm about 6'2", 210 pounds. Grew up wanting to be a racehorse jockey. Those dreams left me at maybe like 9 or 10.
I bet you I'd have a little better chance at that.
pretty obvious that wasn't going to work. And my dad, a similar guy size to me, sort of in terms of stature. And we had some riding horses around the farm, because we primarily breed thoroughbred racehorses here, which don't lend themselves really to amateurs riding. And so I think a little bit as a hoax or whatever, we went up to Lass Tompkins farm in Micanopy, Florida, and bought a Clydesdale horse, Clydesdale mare with one black leg. And that was going to be my dad's riding horse, because he's a bigger guy and he didn't want to ride around on a 14 three-hand quarter horse where he felt like he was, you know, needed roller skates. Anyway, of course, that mare, just by dumb luck, wasn't very good to ride, and she threw everybody off in the family, including me, a couple times. But instead of doing what people with proper wisdom would do, and get another Clydesdale horse that you could ride. We ended up getting a carriage, and we did some training, little like hitch clinics with a guy named Phil Farrell, who worked, he and his dad worked at Grant's Farm for Budweiser, and learned how to put harness on. And so we started driving this mare. She was a little bit better driving than she was riding, but she was no superstar there. The rest was history. Then I started driving around the farm kind of with my dad. It was something that he and I did. And we had a lot of fond memories doing that with my dad. And at some stage, I was like, Dad, you know, you're always trying to write things down. You know, this fence board needs to be fixed. That needs to happen. Why don't you just let me drive the horse and you can write whatever notes you want to write? And that was something that he and I did kind of in the summers for fun. And we had a lot of fun doing that. And then started showing, bought a couple more geldings through the Farrells. And Dean and Kelly Woodbury, when Dean was quite young, came down here and helped us with our first time we took, I think, a six-horse hitch to Florida State Fair, and had some fun with that. And then I went on to work a summer out in Linden, Washington, for a guy named Fred Pollander, who had dairy cattle and some Clydesdale horses, and helped him show horses, and he was driving R6. At that time, we were trying to get a little bit better and a little bit more competitive, and we bought a breeding operation from a gentleman named Paul Cooper. And shortly after that, we realized we needed somebody to help kind of manage and lead the program. And Jim Westbrook joined us. Wonderful guy. And he's, been one of the biggest horseman kind of mentors in my life. And he was here for 9 years, and we grew a successful breeding and hitch operation, where we also had a sort of a farm team that led into, we'd buy younger geldings and send them to Ontario, and they'd go to the Ontario County Fairs with Bob Robertson. And then we would get sort of one gelding out of that program a year. And then one day, a gentleman named George Hoffmeister, called the farm, was a thoroughbred guy, and said, "Hey, I understand you guys have Clydesdale horses. I want to buy Clydesdale horses." And the guy, they sent him to talk to me. I don't know why. I was maybe 16 years old or something like that. And he said, "Well, I want to buy Clydesdale horses." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Can I buy your horses?" And I didn't know better, but I said, "Sure. Everything's for sale at some price when you're 16 years old." So I gave him some retarded price. And he said, "All right, I'll come down next week." And sure enough, the guy shows up next week. And I remember talking to Jim and said, "You know, this guy's not really, he's a thoroughbred horse guy. He's not really, one of us. What we ought to do is put the horses, with their show harness on, and hook them to the nice show wagon. And when he arrives, they should be like all parked ready in the barn aisle. And it'll be impressive." And Jim was like, "Well, why would we do that? We never should, practice with the show harness at home." I said, "Well, if the guy's going to pay that crazy price, you might as well, it has to be like shock and awe." So long story short, we made a really nice presentation. The guy brought his mother-in-law, his kids, and his wife down to Florida when they looked at the horses. The whole family fell in love with it. And we put some hay bales in the back of the wagon, and they went for a little wagon ride, and the kids loved it. And I think within a day, the horses were sold to Hoffmeister's. They went to a gentleman, Edgar Hughes was working there, or had a deal that worked for him at the time. And they went to him, and I think that after, I don't know, maybe a month that wasn't working out really well. And they called me and said, hey, we're having some problems with this horse and that horse. And I said, yeah, you know, you missed some of the special secret sauce. So Jim, I said, if I were you, I'd hire Jim. And so Jim went and worked for them for a few years. And, you know, they didn't have a whole lot of equipment or anything. And Jim just said, well, why do you want to reinvent the wheel? Why don't we just buy their tractor trailer? And they rented our wagon. And I think they bought the harness with the horses, and off to the shows they went, and they were immediately successful.
So that would have been kind of late 90s?
Yeah, mid 90s probably. Something like that, yeah.
Do you ever think back and wonder if you never priced them, maybe you'd still be showing Clydesdales now?
I do. And I have two boys that are 6 and 9 right now. And of course, draft horses are fantastic horses for kids to grow up around, right? Thoroughbred horses and a little bit more flighty horses, they're not so kid friendly. So I've always really, really thought about that. And I take my kids often, like we went down to the show that the Cobbs put on there at the Florida Horse Park, and, Stone Cobbs actually goes to school with my kids. They go to the same school, so they knew Stone, and they were watching him drive. And I said, you guys want to do this? And they were like, well, we're all right, Dad. But I keep trying. And we still own, for whatever it's worth, my dad still is really into kind of arts and artifacts and things like that. He's a major Japanese art collector. And when we had the Clydesdales, we assembled two really nice wagons. One was a stake wagon that we bought from Quailhurst in Oregon, Ben Langston's place, which was a really nice stake wagon, and for driving kind of a pair of horses with. And then we bought we owned a few different wagons, but in the end of the day, there was an old wagon that was at the time owned by the Sigmund family, and was the Meadowbrook Farm wagon. And but it had a lot of really fun history to it. When Neil Armstrong came back from the moon, he rode around Washington, D.C. in the back of it. And those two things are still here in the barn. And so, yeah, there's a part of me that wonders, well, why are they there? And I think I leased the one wagon to Jim for a little while when he was at Victoria McCullough's. But there's a part of me who says, well, maybe someday with my kids, this will be something I'll do. And it'd be fun to do that with our old wagons. But who knows? Maybe there are better wagons out there. And these old clunkers wouldn't be worth anything.
What are the best memories you have? I know you guys won the Classic Series finals a couple times, and what are some of the memories you have of, you know, growing up with the Clydesdales and showing? And
you know, I had a lot of fun. You know, there's a part of some of the Midwestern families that I was around that were really, you know, salt of the earth, really fantastic people, grounded, you know, treated you for who you were and how you treated them and how you conducted yourself. And those fundamental values are things that I try to instill in my kids today. And I think that it was it's not just one person, but growing up as a teenager at those shows, you know, it was like you were left enough rein to learn how to do dangerous things carefully. And you know, whether that was you know, I remember Tom Holst, a guy named Chopper, who worked with us and shod horses for a long time. We were out at the Calgary Stampede, and he always dipped Copenhagen. And I always thought that was kind of neat. You know, I was maybe 14 years old or whatever, and these guys are packing this can of, Copenhagen. And I thought, oh, that's cool. And I kept, you know, I was always watching him, and smelling it. And he said, well, you want to try this? And I said, sure. You know, how do you do it? And he said, well, you just take a little pinch here and put it between your lip and gum. And so I take a pinch of his Copenhagen, pull my lip out and do exactly like I'd watched him do many times. Well, it was no fewer than like 3 minutes later, I am face down in a straw line, puking my guts out. Like if I had any parasite, there was a worm in me, it was out. And I remember Jim, I think, came around the corner. He wasn't around, and he was kind of half responsible for me. My parents weren't there. And he's like, what the hell is going on here? And they're like, well, he's sick. And he's like, why is he sick? And he said, well, he tried Copenhagen and he must have swallowed something. Like, who thought that that was a good idea to let the boss's 14-year-old kid try Copenhagen? Like, what's wrong with you guys? And sure enough, I got rid of every parasite I had. And the only positive memory I have of it is, in fact, puking in a straw line is really handy because you can still breathe. Like the puke goes away from your face and you don't have to move your face. And then it was easy to clean up, you know, couple shovels and a pitchfork into the barrel. And I think the question was, have I ever chewed that, you know, chewed or dipped again? Hell no. Hell no. Every time I see people doing that, and you know, I see people with these little packets, these bandits or whatever, and I'm always, they're like, hey, you want to try one? I'm like, no, it's really okay. At 14, I was full on cured of that curiosity. I'm quite sure there were a few occasions as well where I learned to drink plenty of beer and realized that that wasn't very good. But you also, all those guys, you know, that worked with us, they also taught me to, hey, you know, 6:30 in the morning is going to come, or 6 o'clock in the morning is going to come, and it's going to be time to do chores. So you can drink whatever you want at night, but sleeping in a, you know, a army style cot bed in a tack stall with a little pop-up tent over it, when 6 o'clock in the morning comes and geldings start panging on the door wanting to get fed, you know, you learn to regulate yourself as well. Just as I said, you know, I learned what little boys have to learn: do dangerous things carefully.
Yeah. So basically, your whole life growing up, every day as a child, basically, I mean, it involved with horses. Then is that right?
Yeah. So
for this day,
I was doing Clydesdales and really liked that. And then, as odd as it may seem, I went off to, my dad was working in New York City. And we always had the farm here in Ocala. My family's had it since before I was born. And we would spend sort of every waking vacation moment here. And I decided at 13 or 12 that, hey, I didn't want to live in New York City because I couldn't do horse stuff every day. And I wanted to, but my parents didn't think living in Ocala was going to be really possible. So I went off to boarding school in New Jersey. And then, of course, somebody said, oh, you drive horses. Like, we know somebody who does that. And I met a gentleman named Jimmy Fairclough, who does some combined driving. And I said, oh, I drive horses. And he said, oh, that's neat. Let's, how do you do that? Or what do you do? And I went there and leased a horse and tried my hand at driving a single horse and combined driving my freshman year in high school. And I was kind of still doing the summer fair sort of thing and doing that a little bit more in the fall and spring, and learned to ride horses a bit more and rode horses while I was in school. But every vacation I was still at the farm doing stuff with the draft horses and the Clydesdale program.
Penwoods Equine Products is a family-owned and operated business that strives to support the growth, performance, and longevity of your equine family with our premium nutrition supplements. We make all of our products with locally sourced ingredients right here in the USA, so you can always be sure you're getting the highest quality. We've always been horse people. Our products were developed to take care of our own horses, and we continue to back our supplements with real-world horse owner experience. We're proud of the results, and we love sharing our generations of equine knowledge to help meet all of your horse's needs. We want to get to know you and your horses, and we're here to help with any questions you have. So reach out to us. You're part of the Penwoods family. You can visit us at penwoods.com, email us at info@penwoods.com, or follow us on social media.
So you talked about Florida and New York, but most of your childhood was in Ocala. Is that where you grew up?
So I was born in Ocala. All my vacation time was, but I went to grade school actually in New York City. And then by the time I guess I was 11 or 12, I decided, hey, I want to do horses sort of on a more regular basis. So I was willing to actually not live with my family. And I went to boarding school as a freshman in high school. And then I went off to university. And then it wasn't until to the late 90s when I graduated from Cornell that I decided to move to Ocala and move to the farm and do horses kind of more full time.
And you're on the same farm today that you grew up.
Yeah, I live on the same farm, and it's sort of neat. My niece Chloe Reed, who's a pretty good jumping rider, she actually uses what was the old Hitchgelding barn. That's where she kind of works out of.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you have quite a bit of acreage there, don't you, on the farm?
Yeah, we have. So my mom bought the farm during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was definitely before my time, but I gather the Russians had missiles in Cuba pointed at Florida that could potentially blow up Florida. And so land prices were pretty depressed in Florida. And my mom had the intelligence or fortitude to say, hey, hold on, I think if the Russians blow up Florida, there's going to be bigger problems. I don't think that the U.S. is just going to let that happen without any reaction. So she went ahead and bought the farm. And it's right now, it's about 4,700 acres. We've added contiguous pieces. As recently as a year ago, we bought 40 acres, to add to it. But all the land we've been adding is just contiguous land. And we primarily have, thoroughbred racehorses and then, I don't know, 800 cows or so.
How many studs are you standing there right now?
Right now, none. Unfortunately, the thoroughbred business is sort of interesting, and I don't know exactly how it goes in the draft horse business, but we own some stallions and own some pieces of stallions that we bred, but typically what we like to do is sell a piece of the stallion off to somebody who really runs a stallion station, and that's what they do, and they run a center for studs. Because they have more traffic flow, they have more going on around those horses. And so most of our, because thoroughbreds are still all live cover, and by design or by plan, all of most of the best thoroughbred mares are bred in Lexington, Kentucky, where most of the best stallions stand. And so that kind of becomes a catch-22 in Ocala. There's some commercial breeding, but we do most of that with Ocala stud, because we would just have one or two stallions here. And then you have a lot of marketing expense with them, and people want to come see them all the time, and you have to be kind of set up to do that. And most of our mares we breed to outside stallions, or we own shares in stallions and things like that. And so most, I would say 85% of our mares are bred in Kentucky. They have their foal down here. They go up to Kentucky to get bred back with a foal on their side typically. And then they'd come back down here sort of, you know, when they're three weeks to a month in foal.
So roughly how many thoroughbreds does this consist of? This
program? You know, it's never a polite thing to ask people how many horses they own. seeing that I don't own the thoroughbreds, I think I can answer the question. I think that there's a couple hundred thoroughbreds here. We have a training center that has around 60, and then we have we breed about 40 mares, 38-ish foals a year, and Then they're yearlings and weanlings and, you know, some racehorses that need a little time off, and retired mares and retired horses. So, you know, somewhere in the 200 something horses, but who wants to count?
Yeah.
No, totally understand that.
Yeah. So let's go back to your Clydesdale days growing up as a kid. You did the showmanship, the decorating and the driving and everything then growing up as a kid?
I did. I really liked the decorating because it was a way to get to meet all the girls.
Oh, yeah.
None of the boys wanted, like Shannon Cobbs, he didn't want to do the decorating class. I was like, what do you mean? You get to meet all these girls. Fantastic.
You'd have your mane braided and tail tied in 15 minutes, and the other 15 you were walking.
You just got to meet them, and then of course you weren't as good as the girls. So you were always like, hey, can you teach me this? Can you teach me that? You know, I was a little weasel. That was the way.
Jim would have been a tremendous asset and teacher, I'm sure, at those times too.
He's such a good horseman. You know, I think you could give Jim a group of walruses to take care of, and they'd look, you know, slicker and better than they did when he got there. He just has real knack for that, and he lives now just down the road, and sometimes we do some stuff together. And what a wonderful horseman! Like somebody really, I've always sort of. I still say today, I hope someday somebody calls me a horseman. But that is a real horseman. He can think like a horse, see a horse, and, you know, somebody's ability to go out into a field in sort of Western Alberta and look at, you know, 40 colts running out in a field that all look like, you know, they're covered in burrs and this and that, and just see through all of the mud and dirt and say, hold on, there's a winner. He really has a knack and a gift for that. I remember he went out and bought two horses for us out in, I think it was in Vancouver. And when they arrived, they'd come, I think they arrived in Ocala in the wintertime off the van, and they'd just, you know, traveled diagonally across the United States. And it was probably a week damn near to get them here. And they looked tucked up and like they were ready for the Greyhound races. And sure enough, they were definitely, one of them's name was Handsome, and that horse was not looking handsome that day. But sure enough, some weeks later, we had some shows here in Florida, and they were slick and fat and looked the part.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of, you know, one of the most wonderful things about Jim, and he and I were talking about that is, and I really pride myself on learning this from him, is Jim is a really wonderful horseman, but he's also not afraid to surround himself by people who have complementary skills. So people who synergetically fit together with him. So over the period of time that we were driving geldings, there were times that, you know, Alan Freetag was here, and Todd Dreheim and Todd Scouten, and all the Freetag boys worked here, and they all worked under Jim and learned a lot from him. But if they were good, he'd really let them help manage some of the gelding operations, and he had breeding horses to worry about as well. And he was really good at working with people and kind of helping shepherd them in their careers in a positive light. And he never seems to be tied up by, you know, the scotoma, the blind spot of, hold on, what are the problems and what are the symptoms? I think Jim is really good at looking at a program and looking at a situation and saying, hold on. Because if you fix the symptoms and not the problem, well, you keep having symptoms. But if you're able to actually understand the underlying root cause, I think that really works well.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yep. So growing up, you kind of took us through your life up to like 16 when you showed the Clydes, and then you went into the combined driving. How did that all translate over into the combined driving? And if I remember right, and reading about you, at age 18, you were the youngest driver ever to be named to the U.S. equestrian team. How did that transition take place?
So when I went off to boarding school when I was 13, I was driving one single combined driving horse. So I was doing at one stage the two of them sort of in harmony. I was doing some combined driving, and then by the time I was 16, 17, I was driving up to the six at the shows, and we were fortunate enough to have a really good group of horses at the time. We had a lot of success, which was really fun. I remember winning the championship at the Royal Winter Fair. And of course I'd gone there since I was a little kid, and thought that that was nothing that would ever happen for me. All along, while I was doing the draft horses, I was also during sort of the school year doing some combined driving, and started with a single horse and then drove a pair of horses. And then it wasn't until really 2000, the end of 99, 2000, I started showing four, and have kind of been doing that since then.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say I haven't driven a draft horse or two since then. Sometimes I'm fortunate enough to, I've done some stuff at the Royal Winter Fair, and been able to drive a six. And actually I was, I think 2 years ago, I was fortunate enough to get to drive the Budweiser Clydesdales in a parade. That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still got it in you?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting. I wonder if I got into it again now, how I might change some things. And, you know, I think one of the neat things about horses and horsemanship is you can take a lot of what you've learned from different things and different breeds. And if you can apply those things, but there's a part of me who says, yeah, I'd like to try to put together a group of competitive geldings and see how I could do training them. Be fun. I'm a competitive guy. I know.
Yeah. I know, talking with Craig Range, he kind of says the same thing. Like, if he would have done the combined driving when he was younger, it would have been way more, I would say easier, but he would have worked in some of those driving habits into the drafts as well. Yeah. And he said he thinks it really would have helped him out a lot.
Yeah, I think you can learn a lot of different things. You know, I wish there's a part of me at 48 who wishes I had spent more time really in the end of the 90s. I gave up most of the riding work I did with my horses, because I was just frankly, I think I'm better at driving, at long lining horses and driving single than I am at riding. And of course, when you ride a horse on occasion, you just end up sore the next day, and you really don't do any favors to yourself or the horse. But if you have an hour, I always feel like I'm more productive long lining horse or driving single. But there is some part of me who thinks, wow, could I have been a better driver if I rode a little bit more and understood a little bit of that too.
Mm-hmm. Take us through a little bit of the combined driving, the industry of combined driving, kind of what you do with the horses. I know there's a lot of different things involved in that, dressage and four in hand. And there is single events and stuff
Sure.
So somebody sport, that doesn't know that business very well, just kind of walks.
Yeah, no problem. So the sport is made up of three different disciplines over three different days. The first day is dressage. It's judged by 3 to 5 judges who sit around the edge of the arena and judge it. Of course, I'm now going to use an analogy that I know nothing about, but I think it's like figure skating. You know, you do a test, it'll have 16 different maneuvers or movements. Like if you think about a reining pattern or something like that, and they're judged, one to 10. And they'll have a score sheet and they'll give a 1 to 10 for each of those different movements. Those tests sort of, you drive those for probably, 4 or so years. And then they'll release a new test that might have some different things that are asked of it. So that day is all subjective, just the opinion of the 3 to 5 judges sitting there who give you marks for that stuff. And I guess the idea behind 5 judges is, then one person can't sway the outcome that much. But it also makes a little bit more of an average, and somebody who likes this kind of horse or this kind of way of going a little bit more than that, that works. That's just done in the 4 in hands at the walk, trot, rein back, and halt. Whereas in the singles now they're doing, or for the last 10 years, they've had canter in the tests as well. And some driving breeds, lend themselves to canter a little bit better than others. For example, if the horse has some standard bred in it, hard to get them to have a really nice canter just because they've been bred for centuries to trot. So that subjective day is over. The next day is the cross country marathon. It usually has a warm up section that's about 25 minutes, just working in a field, or maybe there's some roads and tracks that you go do a 25 minute kind of loop, just to warm up the horses. The vets look at the horse, make sure they're healthy, and then they go off on the obstacle section. And there are 7 or 8 obstacle zones that you're timed in. And again, instead of that being a subjective, where it's somebody's opinion, that's completely objective. It's just you have to do the gates in the right order as fast as you can. And it usually involves, water and hills and, lots of different challenges. But you're able to go out and inspect that course on foot yourself and kind of make a game plan for yourself. And then the last day is a cones driving test, where there's a course built with space a couple inches on either side of the wheel. And you have to negotiate that course within a time allowed. And I guess the idea is to show sort of the military discipline of a horse, that a horse could do sort of ceremonial work in the dressage stuff. And then they, i.e. a coronation or something like that. Then they could do battle work like the cross country, and then that they could come back after doing battle work. And then they have this precision test, so they could come back to doing whatever work they did and still have the sort of mental fortitude to not be crazy after running.
So you're using the same horses throughout all 3.
Exactly. So if in combined driving, if you drive 4, you can take 5 to the show and change one horse. And if you drive a pair, you can take 3. If you drive single, you just have one horse to do all the 3 parts with.
Plan ahead for the Young Living Fall Festival and Draft Horse Show at the Young Living Lavender Farm and Distillery in Mona, Utah, September 26th through the 28th. For both locals and visitors, this is a family-friendly way to settle into the fall season. These 3 days offer nonstop fun, from jousting and pony rides to concerts and 2 PRCA rodeos. As you tour the farm, you'll also get an insider's look at the seed-to-seal quality commitment that set Young Living apart and guarantees the premium essential oil Young Living is known for. The Festival Draft Horse Show will host 18 of the top hitches around the country, driven by expert teamsters. These gentle giants will demand your attention with power and pure majesty. There's so much to do and see at the Fall Festival and Draft Horse Show, so come explore, discover, and make some memories with your family.
What kind of horses do you use, like Dutch warm bloods then, or what kind of horses are you using?
Yeah, so I use Dutch harness horses just because that character fits for me. What's neat about the sport is, okay, for the dressage part, there are some things that, you kind of need a nice horse that has a long neck that kind of wants to be, to go in a nice frame. But there's no reason you couldn't use a Morgan horse or a, you know, Lipizzaner. There are lots of breeds of horses that work well for the sport. I just like the Dutch harness horses. Their character, they can be a little bit hard-headed, but their character sort of suits me. And of course, we all have strengths and weaknesses, but I think one of the interesting things to learn about oneself with horses is within the reasonable range of hot and cold, you have to kind of know what works for you. And some people, you know, deal very well with the horse that's, you know, firecracker hot, that doesn't walk hardly, and they're just a really calm person, and that one works for them. And there are other people who, if they just got a tick of lazy in them, know how to inspire them. I'm more the guy who, you know, from I'd like to say I can work with a lot of different kinds of horses, but naturally I'd say I do much better with the horse that's slightly lazy, that needs to be inspired. You got to get them really fit and, you know, feed them right so that they have a little bit more energy. I deal with that one better than the one that's, you know, and doesn't flat foot walk. I don't know. Sometimes I lose my patience with those horses, if I'm honest.
Is it similar to, obviously, in our industry, you know, building a six horse hitch, it's a combination of brains and intelligence and talent, natural talent, and all those things. Is it kind of similar, like you, when you're looking for horses?
Exactly. So you need, you know, okay, if you start with, and I think I learned this from Jim years ago, you know, you fundamentally have to start with the right shape horse. And if Jim, of course, like Josh Minchell was down here the other day, and we were teasing Jim and saying, well, you know, if a horse doesn't look like a halter horse to start with, Jim's not even going to, he's not even going to look at it or try it. You know, he wants them to look good standing still in the end, in the middle of the ring. And Josh is kind of like, if they're really, 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 really fantastic, you could maybe, and Jim's like, absolutely not. So I think that character is really important to me, that they have a good character and they're a little bit, and they're trainable. But the neat thing for me is I have horses in my program that have been in my program for 10 years and been doing the sport for 10 years. If you manage them well, and when they have some issues, you're able to give them some time off. And of course, that's only possible really when you have good depth on the bench. And then that depth on the bench has to be really good depth, because it has to be kind of like, well, this horse isn't really ready to go this week. Let me, you know, put him on the back burner and just give him a little bit more time. Of course, if you just have five horses in the barn, everyone's going to go to the show, right? Whether they need a little time for mentally or for soundness or whatever it is. And so I think for myself, I pay, you know, when I buy horses now, I'm buying sort of 3.5-year-old horses just started in harness, because the challenge is I can't really find the quality horse I want to find that hasn't been kind of, I don't know, messed up a little bit. I'm happy when I find one, and I'm not saying I don't like that. I'd actually much rather buy an 8-year-old that's doing the job than I would, you know, get throwing the dice on a 3.5-year-old. But most of the horses in my program right now come from that I bought young, because
if they're available, really good, you're in trouble usually, or they have some issue, or
you know, nobody wants to sell really great horses if they want to compete there. And I'm usually competing against, when I'm looking to buy horses in Holland or Germany or wherever, I don't live there. You know, I get treated like an outsider. So, even though I can speak the language and I understand, you know, lived there before and understand it a little bit, I'm still a little bit of an outsider. And so I find if I go and look at they're all looking for 4- and 5-year-old horses. And if I'm looking for them, sort of 3.5, then I kind of get to pick through them. And then I usually buy them at 3.5, break them, see what I think of them. If I don't like them, off they go back into the sale, you know, into the ready to get sold pen. And if I like them, then I'll kick them out with their shoes off and let them grow up a little bit and maybe see them back at 5 years old or something.
Speaking of Holland and Germany, you spent quite a bit of time over in Europe, don't you?
Yeah.
Is that like the FEI, USEF? What's the difference in those associations?
Sure. So the USEF is the U.S. Equestrian Federation, and then the FEI is the International Equestrian Federation. So it'd be like, you know, if the Canadians had a Canadian Classic Series organization and the U.S. had one and Mexico had one, then there would be an overall organization that would be the FEI. So that's the international governing body, whereas the other ones are the sort of national governing bodies.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And then, so then you spend quite a bit of your year over in Europe competing as well. Is that right?
Yeah. So the horses will leave this Wednesday at 6 o'clock in the morning. They'll fly out of Atlanta, fly into Frankfurt, Germany, and then they'll be there for a week. And then they'll go by truck and ferry to Windsor Horse Show, which is just outside of Windsor Castle. But of course, England's an island. So the way you get there is by tunnel. There's a tunnel in France that goes there, or there's a ferry, but it's just a little bit more practical to do the hour and a half ferry trip, and it lets everybody get a little break and they can have a coffee and close their eyes for a second if they need to.
Yeah. And how much time will you spend over there then?
My horses will be there until I'd say the 15th of September, at which time they'll come back home here to Ocala, and my kids don't get out of school until the end of May. So I'm going to go over immediately and do two shows in a row. And then I'll come back here and work on my business and, try and make some money and, raise my kids and do what I do. And then sometime in early June, the end of May, I'll go back there and I'll probably be a little bit back and forth to Europe until the 7th of September.
Mm-hmm. Is it hard on the horses as far as transporting them and just the feed differences, the time change, the all of that?
Asked six questions, man. I'm not that smart.
Yeah.
Is it challenging? Yeah, I think the trip is something you have to get organized for, but door to door, the whole trip is round about 24 hours. Whereas the reality is if I were to drive to New Hampshire, it'd be a similar trip. So they go from here to Atlanta. That's about a 7-hour truck drive to a farm where the USDA vet comes and looks at them and signs off on them that they can travel. Then they go to the plane. The plane trip is about 10 hours. And then when they get there, they're in some stalls again for maybe 2-3 hours. And then they hit the road again and go to the farm we base out of, which is again about 5 hours maybe from the airport. And then sort of 24 hours later, they're there. But if they're prepared, they're dead fit right now, so they'll actually work. They may even work a little bit that morning that they leave. They leave around 6:37 on Wednesday morning, and I'll probably get up and work with them all for 10-15 minutes in the round pen, because when they're dead fit, I feel like they act like orangutans on the airplane, whereas if they are out loud to buck and do a little bit of stupid things in the morning, I have one or two horses that can live out at night. So those guys will probably live out that night. They'll have moved around enough. But I feel like the biggest problem you get is taking dead fit horses and then locking them up for 24 hours and not allowing them to get out, move around. That's when they start acting like orangutans. The other question you asked, if I remember it all, was about feed. I feed very much like I have fed different ways over the years, but because I travel back and forth, I feed very much like people fed draft horses. I don't know how people feed draft horses today, but how I learned to feed draft horses in the 90s. So we soak beet pulp, we cook flaxseed, use wheat bran, feed some rice bran, oats, barley, and I do everything on ingredients. And I do that for a few different reasons. And I apologize for offending everybody in the horse feed business. But I find myself with raising kids that if you can keep the sugar out of horses' feed, that's actually helpful. So yeah, they have some sugar from the beet pulp, but most of that, you know, there's no molasses added. You know, I'm buying good quality oats, and that allows me to have a very similar feeding program in Europe and here in the States. I'd say the biggest difference is the quality of hay that you buy in Florida, because of how retardedly, ridiculously expensive it is. Nobody imports bad hay to Florida. It's just there's too much freight in it. So it's all very good quality hay, just because there's a few dollars in every bale and just freight. So what ends up happening is people just buy, you know, beautiful irrigated Idaho hay and stuff like that, and bring it down here. I think that's part of how Shannon Cobbs makes a living, is, you know, growing good quality hay in Indiana and bringing it down here and selling it. But in Germany, especially in Holland, they feed a little bit of relatively dry haylage, which is a little bit funny. You wouldn't do that in Florida because of the heat, but they're feeding wrapped bales of, like, round bales of hay, but probably not as damp as you'd have it for cows, but probably lower moisture wrapped hay. That seems to have some good quality to it. But trying to find really good quality, for example, Timothy hay or alfalfa, that's tricky to find. It seems like Europeans, if I can give them a hard time, they bail the roadside.
Do the horses get off their feet a little bit?
The grain is no problem. The grain is no problem because it's so similar. It just depends. Some, you know, horses are like they are. The ones that look at feed and get fat, they never stop eating. And the ones that the other ones are different. But I think that in general, one of the differences I do is I feed a little bit of haylage when I'm there. And I just wouldn't do that in Florida, just because it's with the heat here and humidity. It would be that'd be a mistake. And I think the last question was about the jet lag, because, of course, it's 6 hours difference there. My preference is to try to change those little things a little bit before we go. But the 6 hours difference, you know, you can change that an hour or two with your feeding times before you even leave, and try to mimic the lights, daylight and things like that. You can play with that gently, but we haven't, knock wood, had a lot of issues with it.
Mm-hmm.
Did I remember all your questions?
Yeah, no, that was fantastic. Great memory.
What are the competitions pretty much the same over there as here, as far as the rules and regulations and the judging and everything?
Yeah, so mainly I compete under the FEI, the international rules here in the United States. So that's... They're all the same. Some of the judges that I'll see there, they'll come over here and judge a little bit too. So that's pretty normal. With that said, the sport's much more of a spectator sport there. And so, like, cross country day in Aachen, Germany, they'll have 30,000-40,000 spectators. So it really feels like you're, and, you know, live TV coverage and stuff like that, which is hard to find in horse sport here in the United States.
And why is that?
I just think the culture of a lot of Europeans is just more horse oriented. People really appreciate horses. And, you know, Aachen is one of my favorite shows to go to. And I would guess that, you know, it's no different than there's golf tournaments every Sunday somewhere in the United States, right? But there's only one Masters. And that event is, you know, got a wall. It has a wall that dates back to the 1930s of every winner of the overall championship there. And I think people kind of grow up and, hey, I want to have my, no different than if you're a tennis player wanting to have your name on the wall at Wimbledon. That's a place where you'd love to have your name up there on that wall.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah. Also fun going over there and listening to our national anthem. I really get tired of listening to some of the other ones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I like telling the Germans, hey, you remember this song, guys? It's a good one.
Shoot.
Summit Professional Services, are you looking for a professionally designed advertisement that's guaranteed to stand out? Or how about having some professional pictures or videos taken that showcases your farm or horses? Look no further. Summit Professional Services is a graphic design and marketing firm who specializes in all things equine. With over 18 years of combined experience, the Summit team has what it takes to get you and your farm noticed. Have Summit come out to your place of business and get an on-location shoot of your horses, farm, or product. These guys are great at what they do. Give them a call. Summit Professional Services, 260-702-9929.
You ever four in hand on some of them? I've seen you go there at the Live Oak International, whip around the waters. Ever get tangled up pretty good? Any good stories?
That can happen. You know, nothing good happens quickly with a horse, right? Everything happens slowly. You know, horse
you see it coming, but there's nothing you can do about it, right?
Horse training is always like a set of stairs, you know. They start with the fundamentals, build it all up, but bad things happen very quickly. Probably one of the worst things that ever happened is I had a lead horse I was out one morning super early with. I was gonna go look at a horse in the afternoon. Or later in the morning, I thought, okay, I'll just work that horse in the morning. And I don't know, it was barely daybreak. And I took him up to the training area we had there, field. And on the way back, he had those kind of devilish ears that are really set super forward on him. And he just shook his head and then the bridle falls. Boom. Oh. And I'm pulling on the reins and I have the reins right here. You know, the bridle's against his neck. When he went from walk to trot, I left. And he went from walk to trot to running full speed, sparks, you know, from the shoes against the asphalt. And then there was a ditch. He tried to jump the ditch, the little buggy he had behind him. It went everywhere. And he kind of ended up in a bit of a pile. And I ran down there and sorted all that out, got the mess untangled, and just like every other horse person, you know, then anybody who's around standing there staring, and you're like, do you think you could give me a hand? And all these people are just mesmerized, like, what the hell just happened? And some old guy helped me. And then I remember I put the bridle back on the horse and hooked him back up immediately. And this guy looked at me and thought, are you nuts? Are you crazy? You're going to drop his horse again? He just ran away. But of course he only ran away because he lost his bridle. And, you know, then he lost his blinders and then he thought the damn buggy was chasing him. And, I don't know. That was not one of my fondest memories. And that horse actually lived on to continue to be a really good driving horse. But I will say that I think he was kind of kid broke before that accident. And after that accident, he wasn't kid broke anymore. He was, you know, if there was a loud noise behind him or you banged into something with the carriage, he had this idea. I don't know. I always have this idea. And once they've run away, that gene doesn't leave them again.
The training on those horses is a little different too. Like you really got to work them, don't you? And like every day for quite a long time too, right?
So we work six days a week, and they kind of start every day with, you know, 12, 15 minute walk. So that adds up to, you know, 25 minutes or so walking in the beginning, and then they work probably for an hour. So they're out for an hour and a half. They go in the paddock after that for a bit. And then usually they come back in the afternoon and do either some water treadmill stuff or some dry treadmill walking. And then maybe, you know, so they'll do that. Depending on the horse and what the horse needs, they'll also do some riding work. And my horses on Sundays, they actually do some gallop sets. So in the cross country, and there's a lot of running or galloping that they have to do. So it's just a little bit more effective to do that under saddle than trying to get four horses all galloping on the same lead. And so I do that mainly under saddle. And then we do basically interval training for the heart rate. So they'll do kind of 2 minutes of gallop, which will take their heart rate from the 130s range up to 180. And then they'll trot for 3 minutes, and then it'll get back to the 120s. And over time, you can train the heart's a muscle, so you can train it, and you can train it to recover. And the idea is in the cross country that they recover a little bit better and quicker. Because of course recovery is important, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Chester, just tell us a little bit about the program you started, the Achieving Sustained Competitive Excellence.
I was asked some time ago to a good buddy of mine said, "Hey, you do horses, but there's a lot that I've learned from you in business that that applies to other things. Have you ever thought about, you know, speaking about, you know, the topic of competitive excellence?" And I was kind of like, "Well, what are you talking about? Like, I just do what I do." And so I'm just going to pull it up here so I can share it. So I was asked to go to actually a telecom company's you know, annual meeting and talk to them about motivational things. And I've trained with a lot of sports psychologists and tried to understand sort of the mental aspect of sport, because that's really important to achieving excellence. And then I started speaking about it. It was interesting, and I've done some work together with the Pacific Institute, which people like Nick Saban from Alabama and Colin Powell have relied on them. And I've done some speaking engagements on that. And basically what I've just done is taken the model of what I've learned from my career in horses, and how to balance that with a better understanding of what competitive excellence is, and, you know, what kind of things drive competitive excellence. So, for example, the five areas or factors that for me drive competitive excellence are fearless effort. You know, you have to be willing to work hard in a fearless way. Enduring discipline. You know, success is not built in a day. It's not what you did one day. It's what you do every day that drive that. Imperfect progress. You know, we all want to get to perfection, but the reality is there's going to be a lot of imperfect steps along the road. And then productive discomfort. It's not going to be fun trying to get better. You know, we all want to get better. We all want to feel, you know, happy every day. But the reality is if you want to go out there and win any title in anything, you're going to have to get comfortable being uncomfortable. And if it's, you know, you want to be comfortable every day, go be the ice cream man. There, you know, everybody likes the ice cream man. But if you want to achieve excellence with horses, you're going to have to work hard, and you're going to have to understand that I'm going to have to do this every day for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And then I'm going to measure the progress of it. Because sometimes when you introduce something new to horses, it actually goes backwards before it goes forwards. And then the last thing sort of I talk a lot about is aggressive humility. You know, I think that that's something that I learned from the draft horse world, but you really have to be humble with your feet on the ground to be successful with horses, because from the White House to the outhouse is a short journey in horses. You know, you will go from zero to hero quickly, or from hero to zero. And, you know, you can, I know every hitch driver out there has, you know, had the perfect group of horses that won the classic series. And then, you know, they lose one swing horse and the whole thing falls apart just because one of the six horses doesn't play nicely. Those are some thoughts. You know, I really like studying sports psychology, because I think if you want to master anything in the world, you have to teach it. So if you want to be great at you know, decorating class or braiding manes and tying tails, you need to actually teach that. Then you have the ability to master it. And we all want to be successful every day, but we have to remember things like, you know, there's a wonderful Michael Jordan quote that says, I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost 300 games, 26 times. I've been trusted to take the game winning shot missed. I've failed over and over again, and that's why I've succeeded. And I think often people get, often people look at it and say, well, that person's always successful. Well, that person is, it's a pretty lonely world out there trying to achieve that kind of success. I think some of those values I really learned from Jim and some of the wonderful guys that I worked around with draft horses. And I love the humility that it didn't matter if you were the winner or the loser that day. Frankly, if you're the winner, it just meant you were going to have to buy the beer. So there was like no prize to win. And it wasn't that we were winning, you know, huge, you know, huge titles. Other things, you know, people say, you know, what makes you successful? And I think it's like in my business life as well. It's competitive excellence. You know, driving yourself not to be good, not to be okay, and not to be average, but, you know, really to look for excellence. Teamwork. I've learned that from frankly the draft horse days. You know, show me a great hitch driver, but I can tell you the guy who's a great driver who's doing everything by himself, there's no chance he's gonna. You know, it's a great group of people. They all have to have different skills that fit together synergetically, where one and one is not two, where one and one is three or four. That's important. So the idea of teamwork makes the dream work. And then focus and attention on the detail. And I found that if I take and I worry about every little teeny detail, all the big picture things of how to win the championship, that takes care of itself. If you just focus on every little detail, the big picture takes care of itself. And then I think you got to condition the mind and body, not only for your horses, but also yourself. I think you have to be able to sit on the box and really have a sense of pride of who you are and how you look, and be able to put your chin in the air. In the end of the day, I always say to my students, "Hey, you paid your entry fee. Go ahead and, you know, drive in there like you did, and you own the place." And here we are. Strategic planning. I sit down every fall and really I think it's a Wayne Lucas quote. He says, you know, there's one attribute across driving, carriage driving, draft horses, race horses, doesn't matter, of that every great horseman has in common, and that is they can cull ruthlessly. And the only way to cull is to sit down, not when you're in the heat of the action, you know, trying to go to all the shows and try to get ready, but it's being able to, at the end of the season, sit down and say, okay, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What are the opportunities I have with the horses and the people around me? What are the threats, you know, that I have to worry about, and try to really plan what success will look like. And then having some mentors around you to help you look at that plan and say, I think you're lying to yourself. You think that horse is better than it is, or I think you're lying to yourself and that horse is better than you thought it was, because you still have in your mind when he was kind of a sophomoric 4-year-old, now he's 6 and can actually do the job. Practice, fundamentals, do your homework, goal setting. I think those things are important. We talked about the details. I'm a big believer in, and I think this is, I'm blessed that this came from the draft horse game, is really paying attention to shoeing and feet. That was always really important in the draft horse game. And so I don't buy horses typically with bad feet. I really focus hard on that. I feel like you can spend an extra $100 with the farrier, or if you want to spend the extra $1,000 with the black with a vet, that's up to you. But somebody's going to spend the money. I think there's some nutrition things you can do to balance the horses out as well. You know, if they all eat the same thing, it's not that they're all going to be the same. You can play around with the differences of barley and oats and figure out what makes horses' energy levels balance. I think that my own conditioning, you know, keeping my own body and mind kind of clear, my own spiritual mind, that's really important to me, and I think become more and more important. We do some cross training. I talked about the water treadmill. We do even do some swimming horses. I always try to focus on the fundamentals of the horses really well, and make sure that they know what they're doing. And I think that that's what allows one to be successful in anything they do. Being organized. I really think if you want to be great, it has to be a team, and you all have to walk in there looking the part and be humble. Because, as I said, you'll go from, you know, hero to zero really quick. So I always tell my guys, if we win, be humble, credit the horses. If we screw up and we lose, blame yourself, because the horses didn't intend to lose ever. That's our job to manage them. It's our job to, and some people say to me, hey, you know, you guys did well. And I always credit, every time I learned that, you know, when it goes well, I credit the horses. When it goes crappy, I say, well, I've made some mistakes. I'd need to be better. Celebrate achievements. That's important. You know, when it goes well, it's really important to have a beer with the guys. There are, if you read Tim Grover, was Michael Jordan and then LeBron strength and conditioning coach. Wonderful book. Relentless. You can listen to it or read it. He talks a lot about mindset and, you know, different people who are really successful. They're finished with a goal, and then they, in a very dry way, go on to the next one. You know, I'm done winning that classic series final, and they're focused on how they're going to get the next group of horses to get back there the next day. And in this book, he talks about Michael Jordan and working with Michael and passing him in the hall after they won an NBA championship. And Michael would say, okay, I'll see you in the morning, to the strength and conditioning coach. And he's like, I knew I was going to see him at 4 o'clock in the morning. And he thought, Michael, we just won a championship. Go get drunk, be hungover tomorrow. You can miss a day working out. That was never his thought process. But I think something that, if you're that kind of relentless and not much of a cleaner, in your mindset and that focused, you also have to learn to step back from that and celebrate with the guys, because you can imprint a team of people very well when it's, you know, if you have success, you got to sit down with the guys or the girls or the team of people who made it happen and celebrate that, because that actually imprints them. Then they actually say, hey, I like this feeling, this feeling of being successful together. And then everybody will, you know, dig a little deeper into their well and bring more success to the program.
The Redrive Podcast is supported by the Draft Horse Journal, the world's foremost heavy horse publication, now celebrating 60 years of quarterly releases since 1964. If you work, breed, exhibit, pull, log, trade, or simply admire heavy horses, the journal should be coming to your mailbox. Visit drafthorsejournal.com to subscribe today.
I try and live a lot with gratitude. Without getting too hokey, you know, I'm a fairly spiritual guy. I try and take my kids to church, and but I think if you can live your life in a manner full of gratitude and focus on what you're hoping for, because where focus goes, energy flows. And so if I don't focus on it, you know, my fears, I focus on what I'm hoping will go really well. And I've taken some of those lessons I've learned from the horses and translated that into running one of the a really, really successful funeral business here in Ocala, and where I knew nothing about the field. I'm not an expert in death care. But now we've been doing that for 5 or so years and have a huge business, and working on getting to about 50% market share in a place where there are 27 players in the market. And people ask, well, how do you do that? And I just took all those lessons I learned from over the years from horses and working with people. And now it's not about horses, but what's that?
That's a great business. There's always job security in that.
It is a great business. It's very, you know, death and taxes will always go on. And people, I remember talking to my mom about it. She said, come on, we grew up with a, you know, soup company here. Like, why do you want to be in the death care business? Like, deal with all these mourning people. And I was like, well, I can tell you, you know, you can't sell a horse to everybody, but I can tell you somebody's going to need a funeral parlor at some stage in their life. So, and I don't know, I had a hospitality background, went to hospitality school for 4 years and just looked at the way that industry was servicing families and thought there's a better way to do this. This is, you know, I wasn't really impressed at how that industry was handling families. And there'd been maybe 15, 20 years before, there'd been a roll up, a lot of public companies had bought all these wonderful funeral homes around the country, and they were worried about numbers more than they were about people's legacy and their families. And we sort of brought that back to it, and have a wonderful team of people who make that work. I'm just a little piece of it, and it's been a lot of fun.
Very well. No, that's a very interesting program that you just discussed, but it seems a lot of your things all kind of comes back to the draft horses and what you learned at an early age, doesn't it? Isn't it?
100%. You know, we talked in the beginning about salt of the earth people and, you know, genuine people that I was fortunate enough to grow up around, people who let you do dangerous things carefully and let you fail and encouraged you when you were down. And, you know, as I you know, I think about some of the fundamental ideas of teaching my own boys the culture of, well, if you win, that means you got to buy everybody beer. And if you lose, well, you get to go drink somebody else's beer. So it's not like you really win. I don't know. I think that I think one of the nicest things that I've learned and tried to take to my life that I've learned from the draft horse people is, I see that my horse life has morphed into a sport where it's much more like golf. You know, sure, you know, at a golf tournament, and I'm talking about golf like I'm an expert at golf. I barely play golf. I can barely break 100. But, you know, ultimately it's you against the course, right? It's not you against the other people. You just want to go out there and have the best day you can. And when I'm showing horses or competing with horses, I just try and get the best tune out of them I can on the day. And I like for them to do what they can do at home in the show ring. But the reality is if we get beat fair and square because the other guys are just better than us, then I got to go home. I got to work on my fundamentals. I got to identify where the issues are. But I don't need to whine about it at the horse show. I need to be grateful that it went as good as it went at home and then go from there. And I feel like often people are, we live in an instant gratification society where everybody wants everything very quickly. But unfortunately, with horses, it takes the time it takes. And I think it's such a blessing to have learned that growing up from horses is it just takes the time it takes. And every time you try and rush it, it seems like you go backwards. So,
well said.
You know, Salt of the Earth, fantastic people. I've learned from the draft horse industry. I think my dad was with the Classic Series. He was really innovative and thoughtful of, you know, how do we create an opportunity for the draft horse industry and allow them to have a series of shows that are really, you know, find a pinnacle in the final. And I think that that's really special to have been part of the family, one of the families who helped found that and support that. A lot of pride here. A lot of
Do you remember when your dad started the Classic Series?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we were putting on the Live Oak International, and guys like Dan Kreitz helped my dad, and he had some great people. And I think my dad had enough perspective. I think when you're in the thick of it every day, sometimes you miss the perspective of being able to step back and look at something from 30,000 feet. And my dad has a wonderful ability and is very tenacious to, I think he was able to look at what was going on in the industry and say, hold on, we need to create a series of elite shows and get shows to, you know, at that time they were able to, you know, ask for more prize money and get the hitches to be able to go around and support them. As an outsider looking in at the draft horses today, one of the biggest concerns I see is I see a lot of private families, farms, and not so many commercial sort of, you know, outfits or operations. And that concerns me a little bit, but, you know, ultimately it's somewhat concerning, but no different than, you know, behind each of those operations that, or hitches that were there in the 90s, there was always a person or somebody who had passion about the horses. So it didn't matter if it was Heinz or, you know, Carlsberg or whatever, Disney. Yeah, they had horses and that was good. But ultimately, there was somebody who was passionate about that. And I think as long as the draft horse industry continues to welcome people into the industry, there's so much salt in the earth of the folks in the draft horse industry. You know, why wouldn't somebody want to be part of that wonderful world?
Very good. Very kind words of you, Chester. Very nice.
Just speak the truth.
Yeah.
I have one question for you, Chester, before we're done.
Yeah.
Do you get nervous before events?
Like a prostitute in church. Open air church.
Like I'm a dry heaver
on a stormy day.
I'm a dry heaver before every six or a sit. So I just was curious if somebody at your level.
Dry heave. Wow. No dry heave. No dry heave. I think that what I've taught myself is I always ask myself this question, am I nervous or excited? And somehow I'm able to talk myself down off that ledge because excitement manifests itself very similar to nerve. To being nervous. And nervousness has a negative connotation, right? So am I nervous? That sounds like, am I, you know, I get, you know, butterflies in the stomach. Do I, am I kind of, you know, do I have to run off to the bathroom? That kind of nervous. Yeah, sometimes I get, but then I ask myself a question. I'm like, am I just excited? Because excited people have the same butterflies, the same, it manifests, but it's a positive way to look at it. But I think if a little nervous is going to make for excellence, a little nervous is going to make for somebody's eye to be just that much more keen and see that horse, you know, lose rhythm behind or something like that, just a second earlier, so that they can do their job as a driver and just make that small little half halt or tweak on the rein that helps the horse have better balance. And I think that I think that when the day comes that I don't care anymore, and I'm just like dead ice in my veins, that's probably the day to hang it all up. But yeah, I get excited. I get a little nervous. But one of the most helpful things to me is, my advice to people is, if you're ever that way, go figure out who your hero is. And if that's the Jim Westbrooks or the Josh Minchels or whoever that is, watch them and pay attention to them. And what I learned in my life is sometimes those people were much more nervous than I was. Because in the end of the day, we shouldn't be really nervous doing what we love doing with horses, because this is not life and death. And if you're really worried about getting run off with, like, I'm not going to be able to hold them, you probably don't have any business taking them into a ring with other horses and families and baby carriages around. Like, if you really think you're going to get run off with, you probably should figure something else out. But I don't know. I see it more like excitement. You know, if I was in the trenches of battle, like getting shot at, I think I'd be nervous. But this is the joy of doing things with horses. And I think the other thing that's interesting about it is, I don't think you do the horse any service. You know, they say that horses can sense somebody's heart rate from about 4 feet away. So I'm really cautious of my own energy and the energy of the people kind of around me in my team. I really don't want people who are like a basket case around the horses, because I feel like that kind of ruins their peace. And horses don't understand that. They're like, what do you mean? You're like my buddy and my friend all the time at home. We, you know, go for water and go out to the paddock and we hook up to the wagon. And now today you're acting like a different person. It's very foreign to the horse. And so I try and have talks with those people and try and say to them, hey, it's no problem if you're nervous, but like, go puke somewhere else, get your shit together, excuse me, and let's just do right by these horses. And if you can kind of, I feel like if you can focus on doing right by the horses, the rest will kind of sort itself out.
Kind of a staple here on the podcast. What's your favorite show you went to?
Ooh, so I could probably turn the microphone. I still have some draft horse trophies up there, but definitely one of my favorite shows in the whole world is still the Royal Winter Fair. Other than that stupid flu or Royal Crud or whatever you want to call it that you seem to always get there, whatever you. That show just has something special, and it's not like I have a hobby or an affinity for looking at butter sculptures or fat pigs or chicken shows or anything like that, but just somehow the synergy of butter and beef cattle and all of it together. And I don't know, I feel like also that crowd, you know, they went with their grandmother or grandfather to that show. And then they're going to take their grandkids there. It's just part of the life of people who live around there. And that's just kind of what you do. So I would say one of my most proudest moments of my competition life was winning winning the overall six horse hitch at the Royal, that was just, you know, that was one of those things you dreamt of as a kid. And when it happened, you kind of were like, did that just happen? And I don't know, still a really, really special show to me, even though that there are lots of reasons why it's absolutely not the nicest show. You know, yeah. You always get sick. The air is terrible. Not such a great place for, you know, the stalls are very pretty, but a lot of horses and tie stalls. And so there are lots of reasons why it's, but there's some charm about it. I don't know. I like
it. Yeah. No, I hear you. I was fortunate enough to win it in 22. And yeah, some days I still think about it and like, how did that happen? Or how you know, why did it happen? But yeah. I guess everything happens for a reason. But, yeah. I tell you what, it's been, this has been awesome, Chester. It's been a real treat sitting down here chatting with you. And
my pleasure.
Great insight and quite a program you got going on there.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have a great team of people that I get to work around. And it's been
Chester, a pleasure. We appreciate you getting on, telling your story. And there's a lot of valuable information in all of it. I think this is one of the better episodes we've ever done.
Well, thank you so much.
I tell you what, this has been great, Chester. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to talk with us and sharing your story. And we'll be sure to have you back on sometime.
All righty. Be good, guys.
Thanks.
We would like to thank Shipshewana Harness and Supply in Shipshewana, Indiana. Mr. Bob Schrock, if you're looking for products for the show ring or at the farm from A to Z, anything you need, horse nutrition, tack, you name it, make sure you check them out, ShipshewanaHarness.com. Follow them on Facebook or visit their shop in beautiful Shipshewana Amish country Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. till 4 p.m., and Saturday, 8 a.m. till 12 noon. Call Mr. Bob Schrock, 260-768-7254 for all your draft horse needs. Thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure you drop by our Reinhold Tack and Western Wear mailbag, podcast@naclassicseries.com. Once again, podcast@naclassicseries.com. Any questions or feedback you might have, we would love to hear from you. I hope you enjoyed the show. Have a great week, and we'll see you down the road.